I've told a couple of groups now, and I want to share here. I think it's important that we look at these pictures as a full story in and of itself, that we don't think of them as one story of 10 pictures and we're moving through those 10 pictures, but actually that we look at each of the pictures, think of the 10 ox herding stories as a collection of 10 separate stories. And each picture represents its own story. So it's fully whole in and of itself. And the reason why that's important is because we're getting into the difficulties of practice, and there can be a tendency to think that this part is the bad part and I gotta get to the good part. That the difficulty was getting on the path. Now I'm on the path. I'm going forward, and it's really all about getting to picture number 9, 8, 9, and 10. That's where I need to be. But this isn't actually true. This is actually each one of these pictures are a place on the path in and of themselves, and they are important in and of themselves, so that we can be on this part of the path anytime, not just in the beginning of our practice and then we move past it. So this catching the ox is this coming into a direct relationship with our genuine mind, our genuine self or genuine mind. The ox is the mind, genuine self. And the only thing I really wanted to share, because I know we've talked about it all month, I just had a couple of things I wanted to share about this picture. So usually we think of genuine mind, our true self, as this honorable, wholesome part of ourselves. Like, I can't wait to get to know, to live out of my genuine self, because then I'm going to be nice and kind and compassionate and loving. And we have this expectation that our genuine self is good and that the ego, ordinary mind, is bad. So I got to get out of that, because that's the habit. That's the problem. I'm trying to get to this altruistic state, which is part of why when we catch the ox, we are struggling so here. It's part of the struggle that we're having in catching this. In truth, our genuine self is neither good nor bad. It is powerful. It's probably the best way to think of it. It's powerful. It's big. It's powerful, like the ox is. But without training, it can do destructive things because it's so powerful. And so coming into relationship in this catching the ox, we are both coming into relationship with the power of our genuine mind, and we have to be mindful of what that mind can do. So the best way I can explain what I'm saying is that we live in the ordinary mind through a lot of concepts. And that's what we're beginning to see, that from the searching to the seeing the glimpses to, seeing the ox, seeing the mind itself, it's all basically conceptual. And so in this picture right here, this fourth picture, we are having a fight between our concept of what we think we're supposed to be and our mind itself, and we're fighting with it. So you can feel this fight when you are meditating and you're trying to get peaceful, and your mind seems distracted, and it won't stay with the breath, and you're keep pulling it back, and there's this tug between, how do I get peaceful? That's what you're trying to do. How do I get still? How do I get peaceful? And you're trying to make the mind be peaceful. But another way to think about it is, the mind is always peaceful. It's always peaceful. We are not peaceful with the mind, but it is always peaceful. So what I'm pointing to is, as soon as we stop trying to make the mind be peaceful and relax into a distracted mind, peacefulness arises. But to get to that place where we no longer fight the mind and try to make it be a certain way, it's important that we struggle in this back and forth. That's what this picture's about. It really is about trying to take this practice and fit it into what we think it ought to be. It's important that we do that. It's important for us to see where it fits and where it doesn't fit. And it's important for us to actually practice with this and not try to move past it. That's why I want us to make sure that we don't treat each of these pictures as moving towards the best picture. And these are the preliminary ones. In this picture, you know, I'm hoping we'll put it up in the chat, or if that's what you can do for people when they go into the groups, you might can put this picture in the chat so that people will have a link to it. But in the picture, you'll notice that the practitioner has got this rope tied around this massive animal, or this massive mind, ox. And the yogi seems smaller than the yogi is much smaller than this ox. And the picture, you can see that almost the genuine mind is way more powerful than we are. But the reason why I think this is important, I mean, it's clear that the ox can run up to high places and drag us along. Like sometimes we're in a meditation and the level of serenity is beautiful, and it's like, how did I get here? And then other times it'll be dead, just run down into a ravine and just stand there. And we're like, okay, let's go to the mountain again. It's not going nowhere. Let's go. Come on. Let's go to the mountain. It's not going nowhere. Just stands there in this like pit. I can't even remember how to feel meditative. I just feel like I'm sitting here waiting for something. And then sometimes it's a big struggle, you know, between me trying to get peaceful and the mind's not getting peaceful. All of that is necessary in this picture of catching the ox. And it's necessary because we are learning how to let go of living our lives conceptually. We're letting go of that. We're learning, when we live in the present moment, it means that we are letting go of the conceptualization of the present moment, and we are going to live with life as it is, whatever's happening. We're going to be okay with that. We're going to be okay. So it doesn't have to be the same way every time. It doesn't have to be a particular way. However it is, this is the way we're going to live. But to get to that place where we could live that free and liberated with whatever arises, we have to be willing to struggle a bit with our concepts and see how awkward and difficult and like trying to fit a round peg in a square hole. We have to see how that difficulty actually is. And that's what I think this catching the ox is pointing to. That's why I think it's so important. Because if we don't have this struggle between our concepts and the truth, then we'll always think our concepts are right. We'll always believe in what we conceptually think the Dhamma is. And we'll never really look outside of it. Why would you? If you're meditating, I mean, I'm going to give you my perfect example. So I meditated for 10 years before I came to Seattle Insight. 10 years. And in those 10 years, I used to sit 45 minutes every day. 45 minutes in my closet, I would meditate every day. But my meditation was a concept. What I basically did was sit, find that sense of dreamy, happy place, and I would sit for 45 minutes and dream about happy things, happy places, things that were going to go good. I just did not recognize that I was thinking. I didn't know that because I live in a concept anyway. I don't know I'm thinking. I'm just meditating. So I'm quiet. I'm still. Every once in a while, I would check in with the breath and I'm still breathing. So I'm good. I'm just settling in. And I thought this was meditation. I didn't even have a clue what I was doing until I came to Rodney. And came to Rodney. I started sitting with Rodney. And all of a sudden, I am having anxiety. It's difficult. He messed it up. And I remember going to him like, my practice is messed up. I had it. And now it's gone. But all of that struggle that I went to, and I think I went through this for about 3 years, with this anxiety, this trying my best to get back to my peaceful place, trying to get back to the true meditation. All of that was necessary because when I actually stopped fighting with the distracted mind and the anxiety and the emotional energy, when I stopped fighting and just included that in as part of the meditation, I was ready to move on to the next picture, the next phase in my practice, the next story. But the story I'm telling you is not the story of how peaceful I am in my sits. I'm telling you the story about this catching the ox and the struggle I had. And that struggle is very important. That's what I'm trying to say. It was very important to my practice that I actually learned to practice with, recognize this isn't working. Something's wrong. I'm trying to fit it in. It's not doing it. I needed to go through that. And that's what this yogi needs to go through. Catching this ox, trying to get this massive being, this massive understanding, this massive potentiality, trying to stick it into its concept of what it thinks the ox should do. That's where we're at here. So I'm thinking this is our month of sharing. I hope we eventually do this, you know, everybody kind of expects it, but this is our week of sharing our artistic expression of what it means to be stuck in that kind of struggle. And I brought a calendar picture. I always have calendars calendars around the house to remind me of certain principles, all these mindfulness calendars you can get. And I like the pictures and I like the calendars and I never want to get rid of them when the year's gone. So I keep them in that's my pictures that are all over the house. And This is what I think this month looks like. I'm going to put on my view so I can see what I'm doing here. So this is what I think. Let's see. How do I get this? Oh, I take the blur off. Take the blur off. There. So can you see that? This is kind of it's a bamboo, but it's all twisted in this kind of knot. It's open, but it's beautiful in the twist itself, but it's twisted together. It's tied together and it's a knot, and yet it's beautiful. And the picture says, no matter how much you try to hold on to something, it will all be gone. That's what it is. No matter how much you try to hold on to something, it will all be gone. In a way, that's what I think we're doing this month. We're trying to hold on to what we believe the practice is, what we believe it's supposed to be. Rightly so, because we don't really know what it is at all right now. We don't know anything. We're just trying to hold on to what we believe it is. And it's a struggle because it doesn't fit completely into our beliefs. So that's really what I wanted to share with you. And I'm hoping that you have brought some understanding. The picture's in the chat, so you can look at it more fully if you want and begin to see what you think. You may not have brought some artistic expression with you, but just look at the picture itself right now. Think about what I said, and what do you think shows up for this picture? All right. So I want to set up some rooms so we have plenty of time to talk, and we have plenty of time afterwards.
Well, I just wanted to make a quick comment that I thought what happened this morning with the tech issue was perfect example of there is no perfect place, and I think we need to learn to live with it. So, wow, how does it get any clearer than that?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It was all part of the plan. You thought it was just a random thing. It was all part of the plan. Go ahead, Terry.
Okay. You can hear me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Sean and Bruce and I communicated a little bit via note, but I was trying to show them this painting that I did of basically myself, and it's the five remembrances that I wrote here. So I did it in watercolor on sort of a impermanent type paper as an expression of the five remembrances.
And I guess it's part of you is like there's a you, and then there's this dying part that's impermanent and not controllable. Ah, yes, very nice.
Yeah, so it's sort of half skeleton, not to be morbid. It's just because there's beauty in death too.
Yes.
So yeah, sort of half and half.
That's right. Just that's right. Very nice. Very nice. Thank you.
Thanks.
Sis, what about you?
So I wanted to read the first half of this poem called The Way It Is by Rosemary Wetola Traumer. Over and over, we break open. We break and we break and we open. For a while, we try to fix the vessel as if to be broken is bad. As if with glue and tape and a steady hand, we might bring things to perfect again. As if they were ever perfect. As if to be broken is not also perfect. As if to be open is not the path toward joy.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that we do this. This is the first time I actually got to do this with a group because I'm usually gone. But this is very nice. Thank you, Suze. Linda, what about you?
Okay, I've been doing my collage thing.
Oh!
And so this is my collage for this picture. So it's sort of showing this meditator down at the bottom here. And then there's all of this stuff.
You can bring it closer to the camera there.
That's coming out of their mind.
Oh, I see. Chaotic. I see.
Yeah, chaotic. So there's some really beautiful things. There's stuff like thinking about a cup of tea. There's just everything. And I think the only thing that isn't quite right about this is that the meditator looks pretty calm and steady. You ought to have someone that's a little bit more freaked out in this picture.
But actually, that's probably true. That's what happens. We're sitting in the hall, you know, and we're all looking all still and stoic. And it looks like we're all peaceful, but really on the inside, it's crazy.
But, so that was my collage for
this. Yeah, that's very nice. It's very nice. Ar, what about you?
I'm going to share my screen for a moment. I actually had a different thing prepared, and then I saw this comic strip this morning, and I was like, oh, that's what I want. Can you see that? Can anyone see that?
Yeah, we can see it.
All right. So this popped up in my email this morning. And it really reminded me of this picture in particular, where there's all this struggle and all this difficulty. So I'll read it real quick. Or maybe you can see it, but yeah. Dear Evolution, why is it so hard being a human? And Evolution responds, oh, that's easy. Consider the roach. If you're a cockroach, you've been in the same body plan for over 100 million years. Coming into existence as a roach is like sitting down in a cushy chair, grooved to precisely accommodate your body. Humans have only been in their current form for about 200,000 years. Being born a human and expecting to enjoy it is like taking the first ever pair of shoes and imagining they'll be comfy, even though they're probably like rat fur stuffed with straw. And then he says, it's so obvious. It explains so much. He says, why do you think babies start life screaming?
That is it.
Isn't it good? I just like that. This is a good point. We're born into these bodies that are imperfect for the lives we live.
Yeah.
We get anxious, you know, maybe we're meant to be escaping a tiger when we feel our heart racing and we get anxious and the blood gets pumping. But really it's that, you know, someone sent us an email that we didn't like, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever it is that's actually getting our heart pumping. And it's kind of cool to think of it as like, you know, we're still evolving to the beings that we need to be to live the lives we live.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like the more we create conveniences to make our lives easier, the harder our lives are becoming because we have a nervous system that's still back in the prehistoric days. Okay, well, you can thank you so much, Arv. You can stop your share and we'll go to Lauren. Lauren, you're muted, though.
I don't have a picture. I have a poem.
That's good.
Which I remembered. I went to Phillip's poetry day long. I think it was last weekend.
Yeah.
And there were just so many poems. But I remembered this one. And I thought it, the way I interpreted it without rereading it was one way. And then I heard your talk. And now I'm questioning, but I'm going to read it anyway.
Okay, good.
Because, yeah, anyway, so it's called This Morning. This morning was something. A little snow lay on the ground. The sun floated in a clear blue sky. The sea was blue and blue green as far as the eye could see. Scarcely a ripple. Calm. I dressed and went for a walk, determined not to return until I took in what nature had to offer. I passed close to some old bent over trees, crossed a field strewn with rocks where snow had drifted, kept going until I reached the bluff, where I gazed at the sea and the sky and the gulls wheeling over the white beach far below. All lovely, all bathed in a pure cold light. But as usual, my thoughts began to wander. I had to will myself to see what I was seeing and nothing else. I had to tell myself, this is what mattered, not the other. And I did see it for a minute or two. For a minute or two, it crowded out the usual musings on what was right and what was wrong, duty, tender memories, thoughts of death, how I should treat with my former wife. All the things that I hoped would go away this morning, the stuff I live with every day, what I've trampled on in order to stay alive. But for a minute or two, I did forget myself and everything else. I know I did, for when I turned back, I didn't know where I was until some birds rose up from the gnarled trees and flew in the direction I needed to be going.
I think that is exactly what I'm talking about.
So what I was thinking is, first I'd like to borrow the picture from Lindell's collage of the perfectly serene meditator, because before I started meditating, I remember a specific picture that was an advertisement in Sunset Magazine, and it was of a young woman meditating, just like that guy.
Your picture is upside down, Linda.
Yeah, the guy on the bottom in her picture. And that's what I thought meditation was. I wanted to do that, and I imagined that, you know, if I could just meditate for a while, just stay on, you know, quiet, just like you were describing, that I would have peace and bliss. So when I had a really difficult problem come up in my life, you know, it was just kind of tearing me apart. I thought, I will meditate and that will solve the problem. But of course, in actuality, just like you, I found that wasn't the case. So what I was thinking with this poem and the picture was that, you know, in real life every day, what is it like? What is it like between the conditioned little ego self with all its conditioning and this aspiration for the potential, you know, that is so much more? Yep. And that this is the way it is. This is the way it is throughout the whole, you know, path, is that there's an aspiration. You want that, you know, you're holding on because you really do want that, even though you're not really sure what all is involved. Then you meet it, and that means there is a standoff between the ego and this thing, because that ego has to dissolve. I mean, that ego has to really, you know, just be taken, you know, like the hospital, plank by plank. So that is a real gut loss. So you're experiencing that gut loss. And yet you're living your life, you know, you have to think about how you treated people. You know, there's the Eightfold Path. And in this, he's remembering, you know, he's thinking about the stuff I live with every day that I trampled on in order to stay alive. And then we've got the memories, and this will continue, that
yes,
that struggle and that concept. But if we keep holding, well, we still have to keep that aspiration. We still have to go in the right direction.
That's right.
Ended. So anyway, I won't say any more. But
actually, what I think we learn to live with is we learn how to continue to see the beauty of the landscape, even though we have this memory of all the difficulties we've gone through. We don't have to have one or the other. That's what I mean. We stop trying to struggle and we learn to accept the fullness of the whole. You are both your harmful ways of being and the altruistic ways of being. We are both of that. And we just hold them both without shame for one and self-righteousness around the other.
So that little 2 minutes, it was, there is little flashes or little moments of beyond the, you know, like something other than the condition, but there's still the condition and there's still, that has to be real. And
yeah. I'm going to go to the other people and then I'll tell you why this is important. I'll tell you one more thing. You just help me think about something. Yeah, Cheryl.
I always draw and paint, but none of it seems to fit. So I'm not going to show any of that. But I found a poem by Audre Lorde called, this isn't the one that I read with Sue's. This is a different one. And I was wondering, is this one better than, you know, more? Anyway, I'm going to read it. It's called Contact Lenses. Lacking what they want to see makes my eyes hungry, and eyes can feel only pain. Once I lived behind thick walls of glass, and my eyes belong to a different ethic, timidly rubbing the edges of whatever turned them on. Seeing usually was a matter of what was in front of my eyes, matching what was behind my brain. Now my eyes have become a part of me, exposed, quick, risky, and open to all the same dangers. I see much better now, and my eyes hurt.
Yeah, that's it. That's what I think it is. You can see how when we do this, the reason why I want to do artistic expressions at the end of the month is because there's a way in which art helps us understand things that are not necessarily understandable by intellect. And that's what I think all of this is pointing to, even that sense of we begin to see clearer. Even though we also see more of the pain, the more of the difficulty. And we're letting that pain in. Great. Thank you so much. Marilyn, how about you?
Well, hi. Thanks, Tueri. I'm new to your discussion about the ox. Mm. But so I don't have any artistic contribution, but I just want to say how much I appreciate your description of your 10 years of bliss that collapsed, because the very first time I meditated was 25 years ago, and I had just read, I think it was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and I had an absolutely blissful meditation. And now 20, 35 years later, I keep carrying that first meditation with almost every meditation that I do. And I would say it kind of haunts me, even though I have a perspective that you just described, that it's not one or the other. It's not, you know, there's a tug, there's room for everything in it now. But at that point, I was pretty sure that's what it was, and I can't help but revisit it a lot. I mean, not quite daily, but almost.
Yeah, well, I think that's what I was pointing to, is that I've been practicing 30 years, but I have a concept of what enlightenment means and how I would be if I were enlightened. I have all that same conceptual understanding. That it's just the nature of the minds we live with, and it has an expectation of what it thinks, and it creates a concept around everything. And so we live in that. But we're beginning to see that as long as you can see that that is a concept and it's not necessarily the truth, then you can still be open to the truth. You don't have to let the truth go just because, I mean, you don't have to let your concept go just because you know it's a concept. It's just a concept. That's just the nature of mind.
It was also such a body felt sense, that experience. Yeah. That's hard to forget, too.
Yeah.
It wasn't just this ideal in my mind. It was this whole body. That's harder. That's pretty hard to let go.
Yes, but that's the concept of it.
Oh, okay.
It's that you think the mind has to be a certain way in order for your body to feel what it feels. So sort of like the whole thing is a thing, but it's not. It just so happened you were probably present in the present moment in that experience. And so, but that's what I mean by it's a concept, not that it's a concept meaning it's only imagination. But even when we have memories, we feel it in the body. We relive it like it's happening right now. Yeah. So the body mind together is the concept. That's why it seems so real, because we feel it. The concept of it is that somehow that moment in time, that meditative sit, is bliss. And that unless I have that feeling, I'm not in bliss. But actually, bliss can be in a state of great pain. Sort of like what Cheryl's poem was saying. You can have blissfulness and you're in a lot of pain, but you're with it and you're not pushing against it. You're just accepting the pain as it is and letting it be. And there's a quality of bliss in that, but it doesn't feel like that positive, pleasurable experience that we call bliss. It's very weird.
Yeah, it's very weird. Thank you.
Bruce, is it you?
Yep, it's me.
It's you.
This is from When Things Fall Apart by Pema Chodron. And it's on a discussion of the four Maras. We think that if we just meditated enough or jogged enough or ate perfect food, everything would be perfect. But from the point of view of someone who is awake, that's death. Seeking security or perfection, rejoicing in feeling confirmed and whole, self-contained and comfortable, is some kind of death. It doesn't have any fresh air. There's no room for something to come in and interpret all that. We are killing the moment by controlling our experience. Doing this is setting ourselves up for failure, because sooner or later, we're going to have an experience we can't control. Our house is going to burn down. Someone we love is going to die. We're going to find out we have cancer. A brick is going to fall out of the sky and hit us on the head. Somebody's going to spill tomato juice all over our white suit, or we're going to arrive at our favorite restaurant and discover that no one has ordered produce and 700 people are coming for lunch. The essence of life is that it is challenging. Sometimes it's sweet, sometimes it's bitter, sometimes your body tenses, sometimes it relaxes or opens, sometimes you have a headache, sometimes you feel 100% healthy. From the awakened perspective, trying to tie up all the loose ends and finally get it together is death, because it involves rejecting your basic experience. There's something aggressive about this approach to life, trying to flatten out all the rough spots and imperfections into a nice, smooth ride.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's Pema.
It's death. I mean, it's like,
queen.
Whoa.
She calls it death. She is the queen of suffering.
From the awakened point of view, it's death. Yeah.
Yes. Isn't that a great line?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it right there. So one thing I want to bring in with everything we're sharing that's very important that we hold in this picture is that even though that ox is humongous and the yogi is a very small as a being, even though that's the way it is. Hold on a minute. Let me see somebody's. What we actually are living with, what's actually important is that the only time to access an awakened mind is in a human birth. So think about it. We are born in an existence that's conditional, that necessarily means that we are going to live in a conceptual world, and that we are going to have to struggle against that conceptual world in order to awaken. And the only time you can awaken is in a human birth, meaning that we have to struggle against that conceptualization. And what I think of a precious human birth is that our lives are not so bad that we just have to survive and we don't have any ability to practice. And our lives are not so good that we're not even going to rock the boat. We just clean slates. We're just sailing through and we're not doing nothing to cause any trouble. We are living in a life where the Dhamma means something, where the practice means something to our sense of attainment. So there's just enough edginess and messed upness and this need to do something and just enough good, positive, inspirational to keep us there. That balance right there in the Dhamma world where we take the Dhamma seriously and we want to practice, this only happens in a human birth. And that's why the Buddha made a big deal about being, I think, being grateful for being in a human birth. And so that's where we're at here. So even though we're in this struggle between our conceptualization and this massive potentiality of the mind, of who we are as beings, if we knew who we were as beings, if we could grasp that, there wouldn't be any more wars. There wouldn't be any more suffering because it wouldn't be. But mostly, we don't know that potentiality. I think it's telling that we only use 10% of our brains. What does that mean? What's the other 90%? What does that mean? What if we use that other 90%? What would that be like? I have no idea what we would be like if we actually used the full capacity of our brains. But the point is that in this month, we have been seeing the struggle between the potentiality and the limited view of the ordinary mind. But it's only the ordinary mind that can lead to our awakening. That can actually allow for that attainment. So don't be so quick to hate that ordinary mind, because that ordinary mind is what is going to be trained. And I don't know if it's the trainer or it's the thing that gets trained, but that ordinary mind is very, very, very important to our overall liberation. It's just limited. It just doesn't have the ability to awaken in itself. It needs this true self. So somehow we are going to learn how to fix that paradox between the ordinary mind's limitedness and this genuine mind self in the ox full potential. And somehow we have to figure out how to blend those two together. That's what we're doing. So thank you so much for the sharing of it. I loved it. We all do when anybody brings anything like that. It just helps us more fully understand the practice of it. And then we'll see you all again next week.